Blog Talk Radio.
Through law enforcement partnerships, community information, and leads, a person of interest has been identified. His name is Robert Bobby E. Primo, Primo III. He is 22 years of age. He is believed to be driving a 2010 silver Honda Fit vehicle, license plate, Illinois, D. David M. Mary, 80653. We have numerous federal, state, and local law enforcement agencies working on apprehending this person's interest. We continue to receive tips from the public and law enforcement partners, and we are following up on every one of them. Individuals who have information to share with the police are urged to contact 1-800-CALL-FBI. Thank you.
Quickly try to answer some questions. Please understand that we have teams out very actively trying to apprehend this individual. He is considered armed and dangerous. Community should not approach him. If they see him, know his whereabouts, see the vehicle, dial 911. We are considering him very dangerous. I can't get into that yet, but investigative lead has led us to this point.
At this time, I'm just going to give you the name and license plate information. I'm concerned about everybody's safety. So Robert E. Primo, Primo III, 22 years of age, believed to be driving a 2010 silver Honda Fit, Illinois license plate, D. David M. Mary, 80653.
Chief Ramsey, how are authorities using the evidence they've collected so far to not only they've identified the suspect as person of interest as 22-year-old male, but to actually go ahead and find the suspect?
Well, first of all, we've done an awful lot of research. Apparently, they traced the firearm, found the last person that purchased it. That's my understanding. But that person not only purchased that assault weapon, but also other firearms as well and guns. That's why they're saying they should consider the individual armed and dangerous. Right now, I'm sure they've got teams out combing the area, not Secret Service, ATF, FBI, Highland Police, Sheriff, State Police, you name it, they have formed up in the teams, and they are going everywhere they believe this person could possibly be. And right now, since they have a tag, a license tag, as well as a vehicle, that's being flashed on highways in the tri-state area, I'm sure, trying to get their hands on this guy. Because remember, tonight is fireworks in a lot of locations, too. He is still not in custody, so they're trying to grab him as quickly as possible.
That's certainly priority number one. Andrew McCabe, you're the former FBI Deputy Director. Tell us what else is going on behind the scenes as authorities try to locate this individual, this suspect, because we know the FBI is deeply involved right now, right?
Absolutely. Wolf, we've heard that from the beginning of this horrible tragedy. So what the Bureau is doing is kind of pushing out in a bunch of different directions. The first is they have analysts and folks in the office who are scouring any sign of social media that this person might have been involved with. It could provide some sort of a tip to associates or locations or things like that that should be checked. They're absolutely talking to his family members, anybody, any folks that he might live with, friends, maybe work associates, everyone that can possibly connect to this guy they'll be talking to, both to see if any of those folks might be helping him in any way, but also to get leads as to where they think he might have gone. And then finally, of course, identifying what we call facilities. Those are email accounts, social media accounts, telephone numbers, things like that. And they'll look at electronic surveillance of those facilities to see if this guy pops his head up, makes a phone call, sends an email or a text to someone like that that might give some sort of a indication of where he is, or that could be used to triangulate his location through a cell tower. So there's a lot of work going on right now.
As you know, Jonathan Wackrow, the law enforcement authorities on the scene right now, they just said they're shortly going to put out a photo or photos of this suspect. How important will that be for the banner?
Well, this is going to be critical, Wolf, because, you know, what law enforcement is doing is, you know, while, as they're running the investigative process, they actually need the public's help. And I think that that's why, and I don't know if we have the number, but, you know, we've heard from law enforcement on the ground that they're asking the public to identify if they have seen anything, seen the suspect. The photo, the description of the car is really going to help. 1-800-CALL-FBI, that's 225-5324, is critical right now. The more information that the public can aid law enforcement on to help capture the suspect is critical.
And Chief Ramsey, we know the authorities want as much information out there as possible to locate the suspect right now. They want the news media, for example, to keep mentioning his name, Robert E. Crimo, C-R-I-M-O, the third, 22 years old, and they're going to be releasing this picture. But they really do need the public's help in locating this individual, right?
Yeah, there's no question about that. And that photo should be coming out fairly soon. Remember, during the Boston bombing, what really led to the apprehension of the individual was when they put the picture up. I mean, that is critically important that they get as much information out as possible to the public. Someone somewhere will spot him and lead authorities for him to make an arrest, hopefully.
Andrew McCabe, the police say, and they just said, they're making what they call significant progress in the investigation, but aren't revealing everything they're learning, at least not yet. What's the strategy behind keeping some of that information confidential?
Well, it's a very delicate balance, Paul. If you want to be able to do some of your investigative steps covertly because you don't want the subject to know if you've developed information like a place that he stays with his girlfriend or a friend's house or things like that, you want to be able to set up covert surveillance on locations that you think he might turn up. But at the same time, as Chief Ramsey and Jonathan mentioned, you also want to crowdsource the identification of this guy. That's why you put the photographs out and you ask for calls to that number that Jonathan just put out. So it's you really go. They're trying to do both things at the same time to give us enough.
Ready to turn your dreams into plans and your actions into achievements? Explore over 70.
And we have been reporting all day long the man wanted and suspected of the mass shooting in Highland Park has been arrested.
Julian Cruz is live with that part of the story this afternoon.
Well, Lourdes and Ray, the massive manhunt is over. An alert for Chicago patrol officer who was in his vehicle, according to Chris Covelli and other law enforcement here, spotting the person of interest and then radioing to other patrol officers in the area. It's not clear if they were also North Chicago. They might have been Lake Forest assisting at that point in time. But they gave a brief chase at that point in time, and then the suspect rolled up to about 41 and Wesley. This will be closer to Lake Forest, and that's when they were able to take this individual into custody, and happened just a short while ago. Person of interest is now being taken to the Highland Park Police Department, where we're going to begin the you know, the next phase of the investigation is to speak with this person to make sure we see that, in fact, he is connected to this incident. Robert Bobby Crimo III has been taken into custody. He will be interviewed by detectives. He was a person of interest who was named within the last couple of hours or so, giving investigators the name of the individual they were looking for, able to put his picture out. Authorities telling us that they received a huge volume of tips, phone calls from people just noticing something out of place or others that know Bobby Crimo. So basically they were able to take him into custody, and among the people who were here to find out exactly what was going on here in Highland Park was the Governor, J.B. Pritzker, and Senator Tammy Duckworth.
We have to do more to keep our community safe. We have to get rid of assault weapons, high-capacity magazines, and so many other additional common sense reforms that wide majorities of Americans are crying out for.
Tammy Duckworth, the Illinois Governor, J.B. Pritzker. They were here talking about the people who have died, grieving the loss of six individuals and the terrible impact had on their families, not to mention more than two dozen other individuals who were injured or seriously injured as a result of this incident that happened just after 10 o'clock this morning, when an individual was seen shooting from the roof of a building near Central and Green Bay Road in downtown Highland Park during the Independence Day parade just after 10 o'clock, when this individual opened fire and then managed to flee the scene for a short while. Once again, though, we just want to repeat that this individual's person of interest is in custody being investigated by detectives. In Highland Park, Julian Cruz, WGN News.
All right, and Julian, I want to take a second to bring folks back to the scene of where that arrest was made. This is a picture that we've been able to obtain of when that arrest was happening of Bobby Cremo III. Again, this is the individual who they've connected or accused of that shooting, that 4th of July shooting in Highland Park. They arrested him within the last half hour or so, and this picture made available. This was in Lake Forest near Buckley, and 41 is what they're telling us. You can see the police officers as they surrounded him, handcuffed him, and then brought them into their vehicle to take him in for processing this afternoon.
Well, that is a dramatic photo for us to get our first look at the suspect that was not part of a driver's license, a DMV photo or a mug shot, but to actually see him. Now, SkyCam 9 is over his vehicle right now. We watched a U.S. Marshal explosive-sniffing dog working the perimeter of the car before those agents could open it up, get inside, and inspect to find what evidence they could. But apparently the dog did not trigger that there was any immediate danger. They were able to get inside. Now you see all the doors are open. They are going through very carefully for a forensic analysis. They wanted to make sure that it is safe. They will bring in a team of investigators who will look for clues that will tell them emphatically that this is the suspect that they've been looking for, and if there are any investigative details that will lead them to understand what might have propelled him, they will be able to ascertain that information.
And, of course, people living in Highland Park or who were at that parade today are happy to hear the news that there has finally been an arrest, because it has been a lot of anxiety throughout the day today, as they, since 10 o'clock this morning, have known that there is someone out there who police considered armed and dangerous who had not been arrested at this hour. Sean Lewis has been at the scene throughout the day in Highland Park covering this mass shooting. Sean, are you doing it now?
Yeah, Lotus and Ray, as you can imagine, you talk about anxiety, that high level of anxiety here. For hours after that shooting, just after 10 o'clock, there is a sense of relief. There's certainly a sense of relief that the person that they were looking for has been caught just north of here in North Chicago. But let's talk about the emotional toll that these people have gone through, not only physically, but that emotional.
We're talking about assault rifles, and one of the things that happened today at the parade, we have been saying we have to ban the assault rifles. It took people's heads off, arms off, and this was a bad situation. We have been saying it all along, but I'm glad they caught the killer. Six people was killed, 26 was injured in that melee. So one of the things I'm saying tonight, that we have to go, the blood of those people is on Congress. The Republicans and Democrats have to do better in order to open up the doors that things can happen. So those people, innocent people, was killed. They was killed for nothing. So that's some of the stuff that happened. We're still talking about what Dr. King said, and we're still doing with that. I want to thank Chief Izzy. When I was on the mountain today with Chief Izzy and the Native American, Chief Izzy told me on my way back coming that I would run into some stuff that was happening. And we sat on the mountain up in South Dakota with Chief Izzy. So we're going to listen to Dr. King. We're going to go give you more information about what's going on with that, because more going on. And that's what we're talking about. This is on April the 3rd.
As I listen to Ralph Abernathy and his eloquent and generous introduction, and then thought about myself, I wondered who he was talking about. It's always good to have your closest friend and associate to say something good about you. And Ralph Abernathy is the best friend that I have in the world. I'm delighted to see each of you here tonight in spite of a storm warning. You reveal that you are determined to go on anyhow. Something is happening in Memphis, something is happening in our world. And you know, if I was standing at the beginning of time with the possibility of taking a kind of general and panoramic view of the whole of human history up to now, and the Almighty said to me, Martin Luther King, which age would you like to live in? I would take my mental flight by Egypt. And I would watch God's children in their magnificent trek from the dark dungeons of Egypt through a rather across the Red Sea, through the wilderness, on toward the Promised Land. And in spite of its magnificence, I wouldn't stop there. I would move on by Greece and take my mind to Mount Olympus. And I would see Plato, Aristotle, Socrates, Euripides, and Aristophanes, the symbol around the Parthenon. And I would watch them around the Parthenon as they discussed the great and eternal issues of reality, but I wouldn't stop there. I would go on even to the great heyday of the Roman Empire. And I would see developments around there through various emperors and leaders, but I wouldn't stop there. I would even come up to the day of the Renaissance and get a quick picture of all that the Renaissance did for the cultural and aesthetic life of man, but I wouldn't stop there. I would even go by the way that the man for whom I'm named had his habitat. And I would watch Martin Luther as he tacks his 95 theses on the door at the Church of Wittenberg, but I wouldn't stop there. I would come on up even to 1963 and watch a vacillating president by the name of Abraham Lincoln finally come to the conclusion that he had to sign the Emancipation Proclamation, but I wouldn't stop there. I would even come up to the early 30s and see a man grappling with the problems of the bankruptcy of his nation and come with an eloquent cry that we have nothing to fear but fear itself, but I wouldn't stop there. Strangely enough, I would turn to the Almighty and say, if you allow me to live just a few years in the second half of the 20th century, I will be happy. Now, that's a strange statement to make because the world is all messed up. The nation is sick. Trouble is in the land. Confusion all around. That's a strange statement. But I know somehow that only when it is dark enough can you see the star. And I see God working in this period of the 20th century in a way that men in some strange way are responding. Something is happening in our world. The masses of people are rising up, and wherever they are assembled today, whether they are in Johannesburg, South Africa, Nairobi, Kenya, Accra, Ghana, New York City, Atlanta, Georgia, Jackson, Mississippi, on Memphis, Tennessee, the cry is always the same, we want to be free. Another reason that I'm happy to live in this period is that we have been forced to a point where we're going to have to grapple with the problems that men have been trying to grapple with through history, but the demands didn't force them to do it. Survival demands that we grapple with it. Men for years now have been talking about war and peace, but now no longer can they just talk about it. It is no longer a choice between violence and nonviolence in this world. It's nonviolence or non-existent. That is where we are today. Also in the human rights revolution, if something isn't done and done in a hurry to bring the colored people of the world out of their long years of poverty, their long years of hurt and neglect, the whole world is doomed. I'm just having a hard time allowing me to live in this period to see what is unfolding. And I'm happy that he's allowed me to be in Lincoln. I can remember
campaign has started to register to vote. I'm going to come to you on
calls that we want to join the Poor People Campaign. It's something that Dr. Martin King taught. We got the story in every speech for the killer that in Africa were the word shot 60 times, 90 times. And those are killing each other, black on black. So we have to be able to take charge and move to the next level. And I will say to you, healing comes by the power of God. And the God within me give me the power to move to the next level. Where it's not setback will come back on my way back. And I want to tell you, this is time for you to stand up. It's time for you to understand we have to come together in order to rally to move this racial situation. Where the Ku Klux Klan movement, where the white Texas movement. But what I want to say to you, free the brothers that's locked up. And I want to pray very shortly. And I want to tell you, as we come this morning,
the civil rights movement in the United States alone, but for those devotees of nonviolence who have moved so courageously against the ramparts of racial injustice and who in the process have acquired a new estimate of their own human worth. Many of them are young and cultured. Others are middle-aged and middle-class. The majority are poor and untutored. But they are all united in the quiet conviction that it is better to suffer in dignity than accept segregation in humiliation. They are the real heroes of the freedom struggle. They are the noble people for whom I'd accept the Nobel Peace Prize. I would like to say also that it is a happy experience to know that so many friends who have worked closely with me over the last few years in this struggle are willing to go into their pocketbooks and their means and their humble financial situations to come to Oslo to be a part of this experience. And naturally, it is a great pleasure and privilege to have my devoted wife, my mother and father, my sister and brother, among the many other friends, my close associate, the one who has been the dearest friend to me in this struggle, Ralph David Abernathy. I would also like to say just a word about the many courtesies extended by the Norwegian people. I have traveled in many lands and many places over the world, but very seldom, if ever, have I found people more friendly than the people of Norway. And we will long remember all of the courtesies extended and your great friendliness. And I particularly want to thank the committee, especially Mr. John, for the eloquent words that he uttered yesterday at the ceremony and yesterday evening at the banquet. I can assure you that all of these expressions of support are of inestimable value for the continuance of my humble efforts to make brotherhood, freedom, and justice realities in the United States of America. This evening, I would like to use this lofty and historic platform to discuss what appears to me to be the most pressing problem confronting mankind today. Modern man has brought the whole world to an awe-inspiring threshold of the future. He has reached new and astonishing peaks of scientific success. He has produced machines that think, and instruments appear into the unfathomable ranges of interstellar space. He has built gigantic bridges to span the sea, and gargantuan buildings to kiss the sky. His airplanes and spaceships have walked distance, placed time in change, and carved the highways through the stratosphere. This is a dazzling picture of modern man's scientific and technological progress. Yet in spite of these spectacular strides in science and technology, and still unlimited ones to come, something basic is missing. That is a sort of poverty of the spirit, which stands in glaring contrast to our scientific and technological abundance. The richer we have become materially, the poorer we have become morally and spiritually. We have learned to fly the air like the birds and swim the sea like fish. But we have not learned the simple art of living together as brothers. Every man lives in two realms, the internal and the external. The internal is that realm of spiritual ends expressed in art, literature, morals, and religion. The external is that complex of devices, techniques, mechanisms, and instrumentalities by means of which we live. Our problem today is that we have allowed the internal to become lost in the external. We have allowed the means by which we live to outdistance the ends for which we live. So much of modern life can be summarized in that arresting dictum of the fourth parole, improved means to an unimproved end. This is a serious predicament, the deep and haunting problem confronting modern man. If we are to survive today, our moral and spiritual lag must be eliminated. Enlarged material power spelled enlarged peril. If that is not proportionate growth of the soul, when the without of man's nature subjugates the within, dark storm clouds begin to form in the world. The problem of spiritual and moral lag, which constitutes modern man's chief dilemma, expresses itself in three larger problems which grow out of man's ethical infantilism. Each of these problems, while appearing to be separate and isolated, is inextricably bound to the other. I refer to racial injustice, poverty, and war. The first problem that I would like to mention is racial injustice. The struggle to eliminate the evil of racial injustice constitutes one of the major struggles of our time. The present upsurge of the Negro people of the United States grows out of a deep and passionate determination to make freedom and equality a reality here and now. In one sense, the civil rights movement in the United States is a special American phenomenon which must be understood in the light of American history and dealt with in terms of the American situation. But on another and more important level, what is happening in the United States today is a relatively small part of a world development. We live in a day, says the philosopher Alfred North Whitehead, when civilization is shifting its basic outlook, a major turning point in history, where the presuppositions on which society is structured are being analyzed, sharply challenged, and profoundly changed. What we are seeing now is a freedom explosion, the realization of an idea whose time has come, to use Victor Hugo's phrase. The deep rumbling of discontent that we hear today is the thunder of disinherited masses rising from dungeons of oppression to the bright hills of freedom. In one majestic chorus, the rising masses are singing in the words of our freedom song, "Ain't gonna let nobody turn us around." All over the world like a fever, the freedom movement is spreading in the widest liberation in history. The great masses of people are determined to end the exploitation of their races and their land. They are awake and moving toward that goal like a tidal wave. You can hear them rumbling in every village street, on the docks and the houses, among the students in the churches, and at political meetings. Historic movement was for several centuries that of the nations and societies of Western Europe out into the rest of the world in conquest of various sorts. That period, the era of colonialism, is at an end. East is meeting West. The earth is being redistributed. Yes, we are shifting our basic outlook. Now, these developments should not surprise any student of history. Oppressed people cannot remain oppressed forever. The yearning for freedom eventually manifests itself. The Bible tells a thrilling story of how Moses stood in Pharaoh's court centuries ago and cried, "Let my people go." This is a kind of opening chapter in a continuing story. The present struggle in the United States is a later chapter in the same unfolding story. Something within has reminded the Negro of his birthright of freedom. And something without has reminded him that it can be gained, consciously or unconsciously. He has been caught up by the zeitgeist. With his black brothers of Africa and his brown and yellow brothers in Asia, South America, and the Caribbean, the United States Negro is moving with a sense of great urgency toward the promised land of racial justice. Fortunately, some significant strides have been made in the struggle to end the long night of racial injustice. We have seen the magnificent drama of independence unfold in Asia and Africa. Just 30 years ago, there were only 3 independent nations in the whole of Africa. But today, 35 African nations have risen from colonial bondage. In the United States, we have witnessed the gradual demise of the system of racial segregation. The Supreme Court's decision of 1954, outlawing segregation in the public schools, gave a legal and constitutional death blow to the whole doctrine of separate but equal. The court decreed that separate facilities are inherently unequal, that to segregate a child on the basis of his race is to deny that child equal protection of the law. This decision came as a great beacon light of hope to millions of disinherited people. Then came that blowing day a few months ago when a strong civil rights bill became the law of the land. This bill, which was first recommended and promoted by President Kennedy, was passed because of the overwhelming support perseverance from millions of Americans, Negro and white. It came as a bright interlude in the long and sometimes turbulent struggle for civil rights, the beginning of a second Emancipation Proclamation, providing a comprehensive legal basis for equality of opportunity. Since the passage of this bill, we have seen some surprising signs of compliance. I'm happy to report that by and large, communities all over the southern part of the United States are obeying the civil rights law and showing remarkable good sense in the process. Another indication that progress is being made was found in the recent presidential election in the United States. The American people revealed great maturity by overwhelmingly rejecting a presidential candidate who had become identified with extremism, racism, and retrogression. The voters of our nation rendered a telling blow to the radical right. They defeated those elements in our society which seek to pit white against Negro and lead the nation down a dangerous fascist path. Now let me not leave you with a false impression. The problem is far from solved. We still have a long, long way to go before the dream of freedom is a reality for the Negro in the United States. Put it figuratively in biblical language, we have left the dusty soils of Egypt, crossed the Red Sea, whose waters have for years been hardened by a long and piercing winter of massive resistance. But before we reach the majestic shores of the Promised Land, that is a frustrating and bewildering wilderness ahead. we must still face prodigious hilltops of opposition and gigantic mountains of resistance. But with patient and firm determination, we will press on until every valley of despair is exalted to new peaks of hope, until every mountain of pride and irrationality is made low by the leavening process of humility and compassion, until the rough places of injustice are transformed into a smooth plane of equality and opportunity, and until the crooked places of prejudice are transformed by the straightening process of bright-eyed wisdom. What the main sections of the civil rights movement in the United States are saying is that the demand for dignity, equality, jobs, and citizenship will not be abandoned or diluted or postponed. If that means resistance and conflict, we shall not flinch. We shall not be cowed. We are no longer afraid. The word that symbolizes the spirit and the outward form of our encounter is nonviolence. And it is doubtless that factor which made it seem appropriate to award a peace prize to one identified with struggle. Broadly speaking, nonviolence in the civil rights struggle has meant not relying on arms and weapons for struggle. It has meant non-cooperation with customs and laws, which are institutional aspects of a regime of discrimination and enslavement. It has meant direct participation of masses in protest rather than reliance on indirect methods, which frequently do not involve masses in action at all. Nonviolence has also meant that my people in the agonizing struggles of recent years have taken suffering upon themselves instead of inflicting it on others. It has meant, as I said, that we are no longer afraid and cowed. But in some substantial degree, it has meant that we do not want to instill fear in others or into the society of which we are a part. The movement does not seek to liberate Negroes at the expense of the humiliation and enslavement of whites. It seeks no victory over anyone. It seeks to liberate American society and to share in the self-liberation of all the people. Violence as a way of achieving racial justice is, I am convinced, both impractical and immoral. I'm not unmindful of the fact that violence often brings about momentary results. Nations have frequently won their independence in battle. But in spite of temporary victories, violence never brings permanent peace. It solves no social problems. It merely creates new and more complicated ones. Violence is impractical because it is a descending spiral, ending in destruction for all. It is immoral because it seeks to humiliate the opponent rather than win his understanding. It seeks to annihilate rather than convert. Violence is immoral because it thrives on hatred rather than love. It destroys community and makes brotherhood impossible. It leaves society in monologue rather than dialogue. Violence ends up defeating itself. It creates bitterness in the survivors and brutality in the destroyer. In a real sense, nonviolence seeks to redeem the spiritual and moral lag that I spoke of earlier as the chief dilemma of modern man. It seeks to secure moral ends through moral means. Nonviolence is a powerful and just weapon. Indeed, it is a weapon unique in history, which cuts without wounding and ennobles a man who wields it. I believe in this method because I think it is the only way to reestablish the broken community. It is a method which seeks to implement the just law by appealing to the conscience of the great decent majority who through blindness, fear, pride, and irrationality have allowed their consciences to sleep. The nonviolent resistors can summarize that message in the following simple terms. We will take direct action against injustice. Despite the failure of governmental and other official agencies to act first, we will not obey unjust laws or submit to unjust practices. We will do this peacefully, openly, cheerfully, because our aim is to persuade. We adopt the means of nonviolence because our end is a community at peace with itself. We will try to persuade with our word. But if our words fail, we will try to persuade. I'm
God, if you feel like it, I see it's all around here. Nothing wrong about it. Just simply so won't it be. You feel like staying in, then don't have to stop. You keep on saying it. But I'm not going to ask you for it. I'm not going to take the time out of my message asking. Why don't you pray with me? I wish I had somebody to pray for me. It's all right. I don't criticize anybody. Any man that does that, that's him. He's got to be himself. But I don't have so much breath to you. I have to do you that to get my message to you. Are you listening? Are you listening? I'm going to raise not more than 2 minutes a question with you, with all of us. And they said, what will I do? Jesus, who is called Christ. Oh, let him be crucified. They all said, let it be crucified. The theme of the subject on which we're going to preach this morning is the inescapable cross. You can't escape it now. You ain't going to get rid of them by the wave of the hand, the nod of the head. I simply just say goodbye now. You're not going to get rid of them. You aren't going to get rid of them by saying I'm going off and washing my hands. I'm not going to be guilty of this innocent man. Don't get rid of them. He's still on hand. Not a word does like it. Are you listening? He's a mole.